I'm Andy Beanstock, Program Director of WYPR, and I'm here tonight to introduce this WYPR special presentation, Baltimore and the Great Depression, about sorrow and hope in Baltimore's epical 1930s. This documentary was written and narrated by Gil Sandler, with a contribution by J. Wynn Russock. And now...
The year is 1929. Baltimore is sharing in the zany good life of the Roaring Twenties, until October 29th, when the stock market crashed and the lights went out. The day marked the beginning of a decade referred to as the Great Depression. This is a history of that historic chapter in Baltimore, told lightheartedly. A word here about technique. There are many excellent histories of the Great Depression in America. Some few focus on Baltimore, and what few there are make for hardcore history, raw data on joblessness, foreclosures, government interventions. I choose to tell the story of the Great Depression in Baltimore through the small stories that make up the big story. They fit together here. So here it is, Baltimore and the Great Depression, stories that tell the story.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
In August of 1930, the Baltimore papers and talk around town crackled with the news. The World Championship of America's Marathon Dance-Offs would be held right here in Baltimore at Carlin's Amusement Park on the number 5 and 33 streetcar lines in Northwest Baltimore. In this time of malaise, there were marathon dances most every night at Carlin's Green Palace, but this marathon dance would be different. Winners of marathon contests, and more about them later, from around the country would be coming to Baltimore to compete. For money, yes, but also for something to do until their luck changed. There was a lot of bad luck in Baltimore in the dark days of the Great Depression, beginning in 1929 with the stock market crash and ending at long last as Baltimore went to war in the late 1930s. They were years of sorrow for some and wrenching fear for most, white and black, young and old, rich and poor. One out of four people found themselves unemployed, let go as stores and factories and businesses shut down. When paychecks stopped, so did the payment of rent and mortgages. Evictions of families were common. Money to buy groceries was scarce. Young men left the city to catch freight trains out to wherever they were going in the hope of finding work, someplace, any place. Banks failed and shut their doors, taking with them the lifetime savings of depositors. One day, one savings were in the bank. The next day, they had been wiped out. Gone! The unemployed, broke, and unable to support families or even themselves, and with poor prospects, sold apples on the street. Life in Baltimore for so many seemed dismal. Hopeless. The number of suicides rose with the sense of hopelessness. And yet, many found ways to make the best of each day. In the late afternoon of August 8, 1930, as it usually was on any Saturday afternoon in summer, the midway of Carlin's Amusement Park was alive with blinking lights, flurrying sawdust, and the familiar cries heard on carnival strips everywhere. Guess your weight, win a prize, take home a Koopie doll. There were long lines to get into the Mountain Speedway, Carlin's version of the Universal Roller Coaster, the Old Mill, the Caterpillar, and the Funhouse. But those lines were mostly of teenagers. The biggest crowd at an older one was forming around a monster of a dance hall, three stories high, built totally of wood, and known as the Green Palace. Green because that was the color it was painted, and palace because that is the fairy tale ambiance the owners used to attract customers only too happy to buy into it. The object of their attention was the event billed for later that evening, nothing less than the opening dance of the championship marathon of the world. Marathon dancing, though popular in other cities, was for some reason during the Depression particularly popular in Baltimore. Many called the experience a sick one, watching dancers dance until they couldn't dance any longer, then to where they couldn't push their bodies any longer, then going beyond that line of endurance to where they couldn't stand up any longer, and then the high point of a couple's participation, the collapse of both to the floor in exhaustion. Last couple standing after as many as 3 and 4 months and longer would be called, in historic irony, the winner. Welcome to the world of marathon dancing, Carlins Park, Baltimore, circa 1930-1939.
I walk along the street of sorrow, the boulevard of broken dreams, where Gigolo and Gigolette can take a kiss without regret, so they forget their broken dreams. You laugh tonight and cry tomorrow when you behold your shattered schemes. Gigolo and Gigolette wake up to find their eyes are wet with tears that tell of broken dreams.
It so happened that about 9:30 of that morning of August 8, 1930, a young man named Claude Bowl, whose daily routine was to walk the streets of Depression Baltimore, joining the hundreds, calling on businesses, asking, begging for jobs that did not exist. Claude Bowl decided he would take a big gamble. He recalled, quote, "I had time on my hands and in my pocket a streetcar transfer that would get me a ride to Carlins Park. I heard that in the Green Palace Ballroom there was going to be a very big marathon dance. They were offering jobs to guys willing to enter. I had no job, no prospects. I figured, what could I lose?" End quote. Here is Claude Bowl's memoir of his experience as a marathon dancer in 1930 as it appeared in the Sun of August 16, 1970. Quote, with permission. "Upon arriving at the Green Palace, I met Betty Williams from Chicago. She needed a partner and asked me to join her. I went home, packed an overnight bag, and hurried back. 28 couples entered in the marathon that night. A few decided before a full day to drop out. Dancers were allowed 3 10-minute rest periods in every 24 hours to go to the bathrooms. In the beginning, there was a 20-minute rest period in each hour. Later, the period was cut down to 10, then to 5, then to 3 minutes of every hour. At some point in the final days and nights, all rest periods were eliminated. The dancers had to keep moving. Each had to lift heels and toes off the floor a minimum of 6 times a minute to be considered in motion. After 2 weeks, day and night, with only those short rest periods for recuperation, my partner collapsed. So did many others. I danced alone. Dancing alone is difficult. With a cooperative partner, you can get a surprising amount of rest while dancing asleep. Your partner guides you in a slow circling of the floor. I often slept 3 and 4 hours at a time that way, and I would wake up reasonably refreshed. Then I would allow my partner to sleep in the same way. After 2 weeks of this, Dorothy Gambini's partner dropped out, and Dorothy teamed up with me. Dorothy and I danced day and night for 3 months.
Potatoes are cheaper, tomatoes are cheaper. Now's the time to fall in love. Why, the butcher, the baker, the old candlestick maker gave their price a downward shove. Grab yourself someone to fry your eggs and bacon. She can live just like a queen on what you're making. You'll find it sunshine or trouble, you're better off double. Now's the time to fall in love.
Claude Bowl continues. Dorothy and I not only danced, we sang. We put on skits. The show was open to the public around the clock. But because the best crowds showed from 2 to 5 in the afternoon and from 8 to 12 at night, we put our extra efforts during those times. I did a comedy bit and some semi-burlesque acts. When you did a solo number and people got to like you, they threw money. After 3 months, Dorothy complained of a stomachache. It got worse and became an attack of appendicitis. There was a physician on hand at all times, as well as a dentist, chiropodist, and a staff of trainers, and Dorothy was sent off to the hospital in time. I danced alone for another week, and then Jimmy Mullet dropped out. His partner, Eleanor Barber, became my partner. Patsy Mason and Buddy Rogers got married on the dance floor. We ate from high tables 8 times a day throughout the day and night, on our feet while dancing. We ate very well. In December, we were down to 3 staggering couples, Eleanor and me, Buddy and Patsy Rogers, and Chris and Hilda Schindel, who got married just before the marathon. In the dark morning of Monday, December 15, 1930, Eleanor fell and couldn't get to her feet again. So I dropped out too. We had danced 4 months and 7 days. Buddy and Pat dropped out a few days later, end quote. The end of Claude Bowles' story and the Marathon Dance Championship of the World a bit later.
Just a gigolo. Everywhere I go, the people know the part that I'm playing. I am paid for every dance. I sell each romance. Every night some heart I'm betraying. Yes, sir, but there'll come a day. I know my youth will pass away. Then what'll they say about me? Oh, when the end comes, I know. They'll say just a gigolo. As life goes on without me. Yes, sir.
In the 1930s, Baltimoreans who were working had reason to worry that soon they would not be. Jobs were scarce. 1/4 of the workforce was unemployed. Baltimoreans with the memory of those days can recall the marches on City Hall, demanding jobs, the banks closing, the household evictions. But in this uncertain world was an institution of sorts, peculiar perhaps to Baltimore. It would prove to be an oasis of hope in a desert of despair, a drugstore. Thomas and Thompson's, on the southeast corner of Baltimore and Light Streets. The store offered to one and all, on its counter, a bowl full of graham crackers, free to all takers. There are survivors' tales. One recalled, quote, like so many men in Baltimore in those days, I was out of a job and down on my luck. So every lunchtime, all of us in the same fix would meet at the counter by the bowl. We'd each buy a glass of milk, maybe 3 cents, and then help ourselves to a dozen or so graham crackers. No matter how many we took, the management kept refilling the bowl, end quote. Another said, quote, we were like a secret society meeting every day in the same place. For the same reason, we would exchange news, who was hiring, where the jobs were. Of the sad memories of those dark days in Baltimore, there is, at least for some, a joyous and poignant and lasting memory, now the stuff of Baltimore history, the lunchtime respite at Thomas and Thompson's drugstore during the Great Depression of the 1930s, offering its never-empty bowl of graham crackers to all takers, all free, providing sustenance to body and soul in a Baltimore that found a way to provide cheer to its own. It is 1936, and you are seated in, really, you have escaped too, the Century Theater on Lexington Street, to live in the fantasy world that the movies offered in those dark days. The movie Love Finds Andy Hardy has ended. A hush of anticipation settles in the darkened theater. Suddenly, down from the projection booth to the stage, a long, thin pencil of light breaks out, leading to the stage where it creates a flattened circle of light. In the circle, a trapdoor opens. Rising out of it slowly is a Wurlitzer organ console. Seated at the console, his back to the audience, his hands roving over the keyboard, is the popular Harvey Hammond, whose sing-alongs at the Century are known to be a tonic for depression blues. A beaming Hammond swings around and faces the audience. He shouts out, "You all ready for some singing? Follow the bouncing ball." They shout out in response, "Yes, yes," and as they do, there on the silver screen, the words of the song appear, and a ball is bouncing from word to word. As the ball bounces on the word, the audience sings it in sync. For 20 minutes of feel good, the audience gets to sing its blues away, a small extra in the price of admission. Then the spotlight fades to dark. The organ and the organist disappear.
The sugar plum world of Harvey Hammond has drawn to an end. The escape from the world of the jobless and breadlines and fear, along with the movie and the singing, come to an end. On their way out of the theater, so does the patron's merry mood. Outside on Lexington Street, through the fairy dust, they see men selling apples.
Smith looks stunning. Did you notice Mrs. Jones' new dress? What did Mr. Brown say to Uncle Benny? Just one of those things, he'd had a few too many. Sure was a hungry crowd. They didn't leave a scrap far over. We ought to feel real proud and mighty glad the darn thing's over.
Please go away and let me sleep.
No more company to feed. No more papers left to read. So what's to do about it? Let's put out the lights and go to bed.
Now, J. Wynn Russick, WIPR's theater critic and the former longtime critic at the Baltimore Sun, takes a look at theater in Baltimore during the Great Depression.
In one of his songs, Stephen Sondheim asks, "In the Depression, was I depressed?" For Baltimore theatergoers during the Great Depression, the answer, sadly, was yes. Broadway may have been trying to raise spirits, but fewer shows traveled to Baltimore. Theaters struggled to hang on, and audiences increasingly turned their attention and limited finances elsewhere. There were occasional happy events. At 12:15 on Christmas Day, 1931, two New York actors performing at Baltimore's Maryland Theater, Henry Fonda and Margaret Sullivan, got married. It was a vote of confidence during tough times. Unlike many, these two had jobs. Fonda dashed off to perform in a Christmas matinee shortly after cutting the wedding cake. Donald Kirkley was the Baltimore Sun's theater critic back then. "The most stubborn optimist must admit that here the so-called legitimate stage is dangerously close to extinction," he wrote during the depths of the Depression. He listed the paucity of plays on tour, the increased interest in motion pictures, and yes, the Depression itself as possible causes. Kirkley did identify some positive notes. Among these, the announcement that Jerome Kern's latest Broadway musical, Roberta, was coming to Baltimore's fabled Ford's Theater. The frothy libretto was emblematic of Broadway diversions for Depression-weary audiences. Otto Harbach's script told the story of a college football star who inherited a Paris dress salon. But during the Baltimore run of this upbeat entertainment, it was impossible to completely ignore hard times. One performance was designated as a benefit to help poverty-stricken Eastern high school students finish their education. Roberta has drifted into semi-obscurity, but it introduced a few songs that became Kern standards, including the following number, sung here by Irene Dunne in the 1935 movie. Ford's, the Maryland, and a theater called simply the Auditorium were among the venues that specialized in bringing Broadway plays and musicals to Baltimore. In addition, there were a few community theaters in town, including the Vagabond Theater, then located on West Reed Street. By 1934, the Vagabond Theater was already America's oldest little theater, but it was in dire danger of closing. The Sun reported that without a significant increase in subscribers, quote, the community will lose one of its most cultural as well as one of its most colorful assets. Apparently, the subscription campaign succeeded, because the next season the Vagabonds went on to produce plays by writers ranging from Eugene O'Neill to George M. Cohan. The grand dame of community theaters continues to this day. Though many theaters faced uncertain futures in the 30s, two new community theaters emerged in 1934, the Negro Little Theater and the shorter-lived Workers' Theater of Baltimore. Unlike theaters that mounted lighter, more popular fare to stay afloat, the Workers' Theater maintained a decidedly political agenda. In May 1935, for example, the Workers' Theater produced a double bill of Clifford Odette's Waiting for Lefty, based on a New York taxi strike, and a play called God's in His Heaven, about American youth who were unable to find work and became vagrants. Back then, as now, harsh reality often gave rise to satire. In February 1935, Moss Hart and Irving Berlin's satirical Broadway review, As Thousands Cheer, came to Ford's Theater. The show mirrored a newspaper, but shied away from the harsher news of the day. It included comic strips, advice to the lovelorn, and a rotogravure section. The show introduced one of Berlin's most famous songs, Easter Parade. This rendition is by Clifton Webb, a member of the original Broadway cast.
In your Easter bonnet, with all the frills upon it, you'll be the grandest lady in the Easter Parade. I'll be all in clover, and when they look you over, I'll be the proudest fellow in the Easter Parade.
Repeated appearances by the great Catherine Cornell, who was particularly fond of Baltimore, were additional theatrical highlights during dark economic times. Classics and period dramas also provided welcome relief. In October 1935, Cornell played the female lead in Romeo and Juliet at the Lyric Theater. The actress was 42 at the time. The Sun's Kirkley called it the best Shakespearean performance, all things considered, this writer has ever seen. By December, Kirkley again found something to cheer about. The impending arrival of Helen Hayes in the American premiere of Lawrence Houseman's Victoria Regina at the Auditorium. It, quote, caught the attention of the theatrical world, he wrote. When the much-heralded play opened, Kirkley praised Hayes' performance as one of the finest achievements of her career. Broadway audiences agreed. Theater historian Gerald Boardman noted that they responded in droves. But overall, the Great Depression made an undeniable dent in Baltimore theater. Offerings and audiences were in short supply. Though the Negro Little Theater lasted until the start of the Second World War, the Workers' Theater was gone by 1938. Even that glimmer of hope sparked by the happy Baltimore wedding of two future movie stars, Henry Fonda and Margaret Sullivan, was squelched. The pair divorced just 15 months after toasting a future of wedded bliss.
In the early afternoon of Thursday, March 9, 1933, downtown at Howard and Lexington Streets, Hoshel Cohn, one of several popular department stores, and the teachers of Baltimore City Public Schools were facing a crisis. To deal with the severe economic depression, President Franklin Roosevelt had closed the banks, taking out of the marketplace all available cash. But Hoshel Cohn, as a service to teachers, had long offered a special service to them. On the last day of the week, the store operated a counter to cash teachers' paychecks at 3 o'clock, a time convenient to the teachers, which traditional bank hours were not. But this day, March 9, 1933, with the banks closed for the bank holiday, Hoshel's had no cash on hand. A quick conference was called among the store's management, including among them a young executive, Walter Sondheim, who would go on to become renowned as a community leader in Baltimore. It turned out that Baltimore City had plenty of cash, but across town at City Hall. Hurriedly, a plan was devised with Mayor Jackson. City Hall could provide the cash if Hoshel's could pick it up at City Hall and right away. With a clock ticking, a Briggs truck was quickly sent for, and young Sondheim was off to City Hall to pick up the cash in time to pay the teachers on schedule. Time, 2:20. Sondheim took his place in the Briggs truck and was rushed east across Lexington Street to City Hall. He dashed in, picked up the cash, got back into the Briggs truck, which went hell-bent back to Hoshel's. In a storybook finish, at the very moment the teachers were arriving, going in one door with the checks to be cashed, Mr. Sondheim was coming in another with the cash. Time, 3:01. President Roosevelt may have saved America's banks, but Walter Sondheim had saved Baltimore's teachers. At 1:30 on the afternoon of July 29, 1930, at Oriole Park, home of the International League Orioles, then at 29th Street and Greenmount Avenue, there were about 3,000 fans in the park, which seated about 12,000. But 3,000 was a pretty good crowd for an afternoon weekday game because the ballpark was a pretty good place to be after a thankless morning looking for a job. But there are also dozens of boys, 10 and 12 and 14 or so, streaming through the entranceway, bypassing the ticket window, and quickly losing themselves in the same crowd. The reason there were so many boys there was that none of them had paid to get in. In these hard times, when money for boys to go to ball games was scarce, the boys had developed the art of hooking in. What was going on was a complete surrender of the Oriole management to the neighborhood boys of Baltimore. The management found itself in a war it finally declared lost. It couldn't stop the boys from climbing over the fences and even tunneling underneath them to get into the park. Hooking in, as the boys themselves described the practice, was so out of control that the Oriole front office tried putting extra police along the fences. But in those innocent days, there was no fence or a policeman guarding it that could keep boys out of a ballpark. But what was Oriole management to do? It could hardly accept the boys' public flaunting of its admission rules. When the management filled one tunnel under the fence, the boys would dig another, a few feet away. And when the tunneling under became too daunting, the boys hoisted one another up and over the fence. Outmaneuvered, the management in its corporate wisdom arrived at a face-saving arrangement. It organized what it called the Knothole Gang, so-called after the holes in old wooden ballpark fences through which boys from the beginning of boys used to watch ball games, and announced that all boys were now members of the newly created Knothole Gang and so were eligible to get in free, guests of Oriole management. So beginning on July 29, 1930, the boys swarmed the gates and were welcomed in, no charge, as members of the Knothole Gang. The management magnanimously took credit for support of the boys and the great game of baseball, but the truth was different. In those hard times when the boys didn't have the price of a ticket, management let them in because they couldn't keep them out.
Come on over here, boy.
What you want, gal?
Play something for me.
Oh, I don't know how to play nothing.
Well, I'll show you now. Oh, you blow through here, the music goes down and around. Whoa, ho, 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 when it comes out here. Now push the first valve down, the music goes down and around. Whoa, ho, 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 when it comes out here.
Two aging baseball players, Wilbert Robinson and John McGraw, were on a cold morning sitting in a duck blind on the eastern shore, waiting for the ducks to take flight. They got to talking about how their bowling business back in Baltimore was falling off, and they concluded that they were losing customers because the balls in the pins were too heavy. Suddenly, a flock of ducks took off and headed skywards. McGraw said to Robinson, "Those ducks looked like 10 pins scattering." The remark set Robinson to thinking about the business-killing heavy bowling balls and the heavy bowling pins currently in use. Robinson and McGraw resolved to do something about the problem. They sprang into action. Back in Baltimore, McGraw called on a woodworker and arranged for the manufacture of smaller, lighter pins. Smaller, lighter balls already existed. McGraw and Robinson called their reworkings duck pins, recalling the moment of inspiration in the duck blind, the ducks in sudden flight, scattering upwards in the morning light. So it was, beginning in the 1920s, in bowling alleys in Baltimore and across the country, the smaller, lighter pins and balls were being substituted for the larger, heavy pins associated with the game for centuries. The new game, thought to be more attractive to the bowlers, came along at a time when it was needed most. It offered a depression-weary Baltimore an inexpensive way to escape from the real world into the bowling alley, a place where innocent competition would provide inexpensive diversion and fellowship with friends and neighbors in a well-lit, make-believe world. In 1934, in the worst of times in Baltimore, there were, in rough comparison, 23 bowling alleys, many more than there are today. The bowlers were organized into dozens of leagues, and members were bowling at least one night a week. But nobody in or out of Baltimore took the smaller pins presented as duck pins all that seriously, until a day in 1939 in a bowling alley called Seidel's in the 4400 block of Belair Road, when a young lady found herself pinch-hitting for a cousin in a bowling league game. Her name was Elizabeth Toots Barger, and her spectacular performance that evening stunned the bowling world. Before she died in 1998, she had taken duck pins to glory and almost single-handedly made Baltimore a leading bowling alley center of America, the duck pin capital of the world. So famous was Toots Barger that her favorite bowling ball is today housed in the Smithsonian. But back to old ball players Wilbert Robinson and John McGraw. They should be alive to see what a flock of ducks did for a town's morale during the worst of times, the Great Depression in Baltimore.
Gone are my blues and gone are my tears. I've got good news to shout in your ears. The long-lost dollar has come back to the fold. With silver you can turn your dreams to gold. Oh. We're in the money, we're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along. We're in the money, the sky is sunny. Oh man, depression, you are through, you done us wrong. Oh.
On Saturday night, July 29th, 1937, crowds are converging on the Light Street Wars, a churning muddle of produce trucks, streetcars, pedestrians, and bay steamers. The crowds make their way to Pier 5, where they buy a ticket to Dreamland by boarding a three-decker excursion boat called the Bay Belle. It is a nightly moonlighter down the river, a part of Baltimore life in those rough and uncertain times. Also boarding and going quickly to the dance floor on the second deck is young Nick Longo. Minutes later, the Bay Belle is downstream, and the orchestra of Bob Craig is beating out the rhythms of Flatfoot Fluji. And by now, Nick has a partner. with whom he is whirling and dipping and shagging in a dance loosely called in 1930s talk, jitterbugging. Between dances, one of the couples takes respite by going up one deck to the top deck. Above, the night sky, usually star-studded, is, when luck holds, moonlit. On all sides are the sights of Baltimore Harbor, the flames of Bethlehem Steel's furnaces dancing on the water, lights of the shipyards playing on the sides of the hulking freighters. By 10 o'clock, the Bay Bell is at the landmark 7-foot knoll, where it churns itself around and heads home. The music by now is in the mood of the dancers. The raucous flat-foot flugie has given way to the soporific Good Night, Sweetheart. At 10:30, the Bay Bell eases through the night into her dock, and Nick Longo and all who danced aboard the Bay Bell in those years take the streetcars home. Aboard, romantics among them are left to ponder the escape from the world of the Great Depression into dreamland.
Sailing through the moonlight, sailing on the bay.
We were sailing along on Moonlight Bay. We could hear the voices ringing. They seemed to say.
Shortly after midnight, in the early morning hour of July 5th, 1938, fire broke out in the loop-de-loop ride in an amusement park and bathing beach on Rock Creek, south of Baltimore, slightly to the west of Sandy Point. The blaze, reported as spectacular, was raging out of control by the time the Riviera Beach Fire Department arrived. A second alarm brought the Orchard Beach Fire Department to the scene. But it was all too late. When the smoke had cleared, a pile of smoldering rubble on the shores of Rock Creek was all that was left of the racer dip, merry-go-round, refreshment stands, picnic rows, and bathhouse of what was once Brown's Grove. News of the fire created little stir in Baltimore's white community, but in the African-American community there was much sadness and reminiscence. In these hard and segregated times, when there were two Baltimores, one black and one white, Brown's Grove was held dear by African Americans. It was the only seaside beach open to them that was served by its own excursion boat. The resort provided them with recreation and social engagement denied them in a segregated Baltimore. Former TV personality Chuck Richards, a longtime Baltimorean and African American, recalled, "We boarded the excursion boat Starlight at Fells Point, and I remember the lovely 45-minute ride over and back. We spend the day picnicking, enjoying the amusement park rides and swimming. Later in the evening, as dusk came on, we took the excursion boat back. There was always plenty of dancing." Both Brown's Grove and the excursion boat that served it were owned by Captain George Brown. Brown arrived in Baltimore in 1893, an unemployed African-American with, he was fond of saying, just enough baggage to fill a cigar box. Some 40 years later, he had become prosperous and prominent. Brown died in 1935, 3 years before the fire. He did not live to see the day when the burning down of his beloved Brown's Grove, serving Baltimore's African Americans barred from the white-only beaches, would not have mattered. It was no longer needed. But in the 1930s, it was. Mr. Richards said, other than Carr's Beach, which was down near Annapolis, there was no other beach open to African Americans. And in Depression Baltimore, money was short. But what you had went pretty far at Brown's Grove. It is a hot and languid summer night in the late 1930s on the grassy acreage sloping down from the mansion house to the boat lake in Drute Hill Park. These years of depression were not the best of times, but you would never have known it from the mood of the thousand or so people lounging about the lawn surrounding on chairs and blankets, listening to this concert in the park. The band is playing in the good old summertime, and Ken Clark, the genial MC, is leading the audience in a sing-along. And it's all free, no small matter in these times, all courtesy of the city of Baltimore.
The band plays with some uncertainty, with here and there a discordant note that no one in the crowd seems to notice. What has the crowd's attention is the scene being played out on the grand stage. Mr. Clark announces to the crowd, "We have up here 6 children who have lost their parents." From the audience come shouts, couples claiming their lost brood. The music starts again. This time it is Moonlight Bay, and again Mr. Clark leads the sing-along. And once again, when the singing comes to an end, Mr. Clark is announcing from the stage that he now has 4 lost children, and again the strays are quickly reunited with their parents. The music starts up again, this time to Goodnight Sweetheart, and again, here and there, the band is vaguely off-key. By this time of the evening, the daylight has faded. The heat of the day has given way to the freshening breezes of the oncoming night. The musicians pack up their instruments. The crowd disperses. This sylvan scene would be replayed in Drood Hill Park in exactly the same way many times before the concerts, which had begun in the Great Depression, closed down sometime during World War II. But not before, we can be sure. MC Ken Clark's reputation for finding children wandering around lost in the half-light of those long-ago summer nights, not before every one of those lost children was returned to welcoming and relieved parents in the Drood Hill Park of the years of the Great Depression.
Now grab your coat and snatch your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear that pitter-pat? And that happy tune is your step. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street.
Early in the morning of October 7th, 1932, a crowd had gathered in front of the Park Bank at Lexington and Charles Streets in the heart of downtown Baltimore. They were among the bank's depositors and were there in a desperate attempt to withdraw their savings because the bank, like so many in those days of the Great Depression, had failed and was unable to make good on the money drawn on it. When the doors opened, the crowd rushed the tellers, who explained that the bank was effectively broke and was now in the hands of the state banking commissioner. The despondent customers went away empty-handed, save one, an elderly Chinese immigrant named Sam Lee. To the wonder and envy of the frustrated crowd, a teller handed Mr. Lee a check for $530.45. Mr. Sam Lee was the only depositor in Baltimore to recoup his savings from a bank during the nightmare days of the Great Depression when the banks were closed, and this is the story of his good luck. A few months earlier, Sam had decided that he wanted to go home to China, but realized he didn't have the money. Friends raised $530.45 and presented him with a check for that amount. Sam, not up on the news about the Park Bank's failing, looked for the nearest bank and walked into, of all places, the Park Bank. When Sam came back on October 7, 1932, to withdraw his money, the bank had been taken over by the banking commission, and Sam could not get his money. Sympathetic friends retained a lawyer, who filed a petition with the court, which set forth as follows, quote, "Because of Sam Lee's desire to return to China where his children could comfort him in his old age, and because he lacked the funds, and because a collection was taken up to pay for his return to his native land, and because he had, without realizing it, deposited the money into a bank that was failing, we ask that a check for $530.45 be returned to Sam," end quote. The bank commissioner confirmed Sam's story, whereupon Judge Stein ruled that Sam should get his money back. He did. Then the Park Bank went into receivership, and Mr. Sam Lee went back to China.
Once in a while. to give one little thought to me, so someone else may be nearer your heart. Ooh. Once in a while, will you dream of the moments I shared with you? Moments before we two drifted apart.
Sometime in the late 1930s, say 1937 or 1938, 1939, without any formal declaration, Baltimore went to war, a few years before America did. And by the time the Japanese struck at Pearl Harbor, the look and feel of the city had already changed to a wartime look and feel. Movies, restaurants, and public places were overflowing with shift workers from Baltimore's many war production plants, Glenn L. Martin, Westinghouse, Bendix, the Bethlehem shipyards, churning out planes and guns and ships and tanks and radios and the materiel of war. So overcrowded were living conditions in these times that people were sleeping on what were called hotbeds. A landlord would rent by day for a worker on the night shift, then for a night to a worker who worked on the day shift. Same bed. Downtown streets were overflowing, too, with soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen, lonely, away from home, with nothing to do. And that is why, in the late 1930s, the city fathers were quick to set up USOs, United Service Organizations, venues where servicemen and women could come in off the streets and visit and spend as much time there as they had. Their presence changed the landscape and the tone and mood of the city. But mostly, what the servicemen and women did in the USO was to dance away the night to music that sounded like this. There were USOs at 309 North Charles, at the Jewish Educational Center at 301 West Monument Street, at the YMCA at Charles and Franklin Street, and in segregated Baltimore, two so-called separate but equal USOs for African Americans, one on Drude Hill Avenue, the other at Gold and Brunt Streets. But back to that night at Carlin's Park and the last days and nights of the marathon dance-off to see who would be the champion marathon dancers of the world. Claude Bowl recalled, "Eleanor fell and couldn't get to her feet. I dropped out, too. I had danced for 4 months and 7 days." Buddy and Pat dropped out a few days later. Claude said the Shindells won first prize, $1,000 each. The Rogers took second place and got $600 each. Eleanor and I won third prize at $400 each. During the contest, I had picked up about $500 additional money by selling autographed photographs and from solo tips thrown my way on the floor. Like the others, I stayed in the area of the ballroom for 5 days and nights under the watchful eye of the trainers, who got me up every 2 or 3 hours to keep my muscles from knotting. Finally, I was ready to go home. I slept 16 hours a night for a week.
Together, shout it now, there's no one who can doubt it now, so let's celebrate.
The Great Depression has been largely forgotten. Most who can remember its bleakness and how the tapestry of American capitalism was ripped into bleeding shreds have passed away, taking with them the loneliness and humiliation of sudden and unforgiving poverty. Since, decades of prosperity, three-car garages, savings insurance, a consumer-driven society, a better understanding of the country's economy, all have put the Great Depression in Baltimore into the dustbin of our history. If it is mentioned at all, it is as a museum piece, a thinly veiled reference to caution and a cynicism about life, putting into the language the words depression mentality. Many have inherited the fixation, and to this day the sons and daughters of its victims show traces of it. The Great Depression in Baltimore did not end with a declaration. Its end was not legislated. It ended slowly, imperceptibly, as early as 1935, with the coming of Roosevelt's New Deal and government spending on the production of the materiel of war, guns and chips and planes and tanks. The money so spent may have ended the Great Depression, but not the small stories about the sorrows and the many ways Baltimoreans, rich and poor, white and black, young and old, found a way to live with the times and to survive them. These small stories together tell the big story of Baltimore and the Great Depression. The Great Depression's mark on our history is indelible. The events of those years have affected how we view the government's role in our lives, how the financial world has evolved, how we, our children and their children too, live our lives down to this day.
You've been listening to Baltimore in the Great Depression, about sorrow and hope in Baltimore's epical 1930s. This documentary was written and narrated by Gil Sandler. Theater in Baltimore in those years was by J. Wynn Russick. Music has been provided by Ken Jackson. Production by Luke Spicknall. I'm Andy Bienstock, and this is 88.1 WIPR.